Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
A lot of our herbicides for post-emergence application in wheat can be applied either fall or spring, but really the key driver is how big is the wheat. So some of them need to be, you know, generally 2 to 3 leaf on your wheat, and then some of them have cutoffs on the backside of, you know, anything from jointing to boot. So just being aware of what those cutoffs are is important to avoid damaging your wheat.
Kansas State wheat specialist Sarah Lancaster.
Honestly, as with most crops, the sooner the better. You will, generally speaking, do a better job of preserving yield potential when you take that weed competition out in the fall. Obviously, better late than never, but generally speaking, we'll see better weed control if we spray in the fall compared to in the spring, and then better yield potential as well.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My colleagues and I remain squarely focused on achieving our dual mandate goals of maximum employment and stable prices for the benefit of the American people.
Jerome Powell is chairman of the Federal Reserve following the Open Market Committee meeting on Wednesday.
The economy is strong overall and has made significant progress toward our goals over the past 2 years. Labor market conditions are solid, and inflation has moved closer to our 2% longer-run goal, though it remains somewhat elevated. In support of our goals, today the Federal Open Market Committee decided to leave our policy interest rate unchanged. We also made the technical decision to slow the pace of decline in the size of our balance sheet. I'll have more to say about these decisions after briefly reviewing economic developments. Economic activity continued to expand at a solid pace in the fourth quarter of last year, with GDP rising at 2.3%. Recent indications, however, point to a moderation in consumer spending following the rapid growth seen over the second half of 2024. Surveys of households and businesses point to heightened uncertainty about the economic outlook. It remains to be seen how these developments might affect future spending and investment. In our summary of economic projections, the median participant projects GDP to rise 1.7% this year, somewhat lower than projected in December, and to rise a bit below 2% over the next 2 years. In the labor market, conditions remain solid. Payroll job gains averaged 200,000 per month over the past 3 months. The unemployment rate at 4.1% remains low and is held in a narrow range for the past year. The jobs-to-workers gap has held steady for several months. Wages are growing faster than inflation and at a more sustainable pace than earlier in the pandemic recovery. Overall, a wide set of indicators suggests that conditions in the labor market are broadly in balance. The labor market is not a source of significant inflationary pressures. The median projection for the unemployment rate in the SEP is 4.4% at the end of this year and 4.3% over the next 2 years. Inflation has eased significantly over the past 2 years, but remains somewhat elevated relative to our 2% longer-run goal. Estimates based on the Consumer Price Index and other data indicate that total PCE prices rose 2.5% over the 12 months ending in February, and that, excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core PCE prices rose 2.8%. Some near-term measures of inflation expectations have recently moved up. We see this in both market and survey-based measures, and survey respondents, both consumers and businesses, are mentioning tariffs as a driving factor. Beyond the next year or so, however, most measures of longer-term expectations remain consistent with our 2% inflation goal. The median projection in the SEP for total PCE inflation is 2.7% this year and 2.2% next year, a little higher than projected in December. In 2027, the median projection is at our 2% objective. Our monetary policy actions are guided by our dual mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. At today's meeting, the committee decided to maintain the target range for the federal funds rate at 4.25% to 4.5%. Looking ahead, the new administration is in the process of implementing significant policy changes in four distinct areas: trade, immigration, fiscal policy, and regulation. It is the net effect of these policy changes that will matter for the economy and for the path of monetary policy.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Okay, so a couple things. The grocery bill is about past inflation, really.
Jerome Powell is chairman of the Federal Reserve.
And there was inflation in 21, 2, and 3, and prices went up. The current level, it's not the change in prices. It's they're unhappy, and they're not wrong to be unhappy, that prices went up quite a bit, and they're paying a lot for those things. So that's, I think that is the fundamental fact, and has been for a long time, a couple of years, why people are unhappy with the economy. It's not that the economy is not growing. It's not that inflation is really high. It's not that unemployment is high. It's none of those things. We have, 4.1% unemployment. We've got 2% growth. And, it's a pretty good economy. But people are unhappy because of the price level. And I do. We completely understand and accept that.
A highlight of food price inflation has been eggs. Tyler Cousins, director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
So in that retail price discussion side of things, they do report egg prices there, and eggs have definitely been one of those items that have popped up in the news cycles and just noted a little bit more there. And so I want to bring up some discussion on the egg side of things and just HPAI. Eggs have been getting a little bit more of this attention. And actually in February, those retail egg prices reported were $5.90 per dozen. That's actually nearly double the $3 per pound price that was reported a year ago. February's egg price of $5.90 per dozen was also a record price. And as you might expect, a lot of this is just due to highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, as this has been a primary factor driving a lot of these egg prices higher, as it's affected a lot of these egg layer flocks. So one of the things that I did was pull some of the more recent data from USDA's APHIS on just the HPAI outbreaks across the U.S. and the poultry sector. And if we kind of look at 2025 here, since the start of the year, APHIS is actually reporting 36.1 million birds affected by HPAI. This is a significant amount of birds affected in just over 2 months. So if we kind of compare this to some of those prior years, total birds affected over the whole year by HPAI was 58 million in 2022, 22 million in 2023, and 51 million in 2024. So to reach this 36 million mark for birds affected in just over 2 months is a much faster pace than what we saw in prior years with these HPAI cases. So if we kind of break this down a little bit more and look at what sectors of the poultry industry have been impacted a little bit more, disproportionately, the egg layers are the ones that are affected more significantly here. So in 2025, about 86% of the cases, total cases reported, have been on the egg side of things, primarily egg layers. But if we look at kind of past years, HPAI outbreaks, egg layers and just sort of egg side of things have been hit primarily the worst, taking a brunt of all of this. But also you're seeing some impacts in the turkey and broiler side of things. But I think just the overall effects have been on the egg layer side of things, which is why you're seeing some of this volatility in egg prices and industry trying to just adjust to supply constraints and just meeting the demand of eggs in the market as a whole. So one thing we have to keep in mind here that from a seasonal standpoint, from one of the things we've seen from some of these prior HPAI outbreaks, reported cases typically increase during the migratory seasons in March and April. And then again during the fourth quarter of the year. So potentially, we're sitting here in March that we may see more cases yet ahead once the migratory season is in full swing, which could further impact the poultry supplies and just the poultry industry as a whole.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
A lot of these herbicides are going to have labels to be used with nitrogen as a nitrogen fertilizer as a carrier.
Sarah Lancaster is a Kansas State weed specialist.
Some of these products say that you can mix with up to a certain percentage of UAN as a carrier. So just being aware of what you're putting in the tank and how well it's going to play with the UAN as a carrier there is important, especially for like those amine formulations of things like 2,4-D.
The focus is considerations for wheat herbicides.
Thinking about going through flag leaf, kind of some of the big ones there would be some of the newer products from Corteva that include that active ingredient of haloxifen, which is the trade name there is Elevor. So some of those would be Pixaro, Culex, Resuvent, and Wide Arm Match. So, again, those are going to bring some broadleaf control, not necessarily for our summer annuals, but for mare's tail, mustards, and henbit.
And then there's the issue of jointed goat grass management.
One of the things that I was asked to speak about this winter with Dr. Alan Fritz, since he's the real scientist, right? He does the wheat breeding and understands the genetics. We've been talking a little bit this winter about outcrossing between jointed goat grass and wheat. So jointed goat grass is essentially a wild relative of wheat, and there is a potential for wheat and jointed goat grass to cross-pollinate. So one of the reasons that's important is because we mentioned Clearfield wheats and coaxium wheats when we were talking about some of these application choices. And that creates an additional opportunity to create herbicide resistance. So there was some work done in the Pacific Northwest, and they tracked how far the wheat pollen will like move and transfer into jointed goat grass. And it's something like 250 feet, something in that ballpark. So not super far, but far enough that if you have jointed goat grass that's not controlled, say in your road ditches or your field borders, right, we could start to have problems. The frequency of occurrence is not super high, but when you start thinking about the number of plants that we're dealing with, right, even if it's a low frequency of a high number can still be, in some situations, can be meaningful, right? What we do is, so now we have herbicides that are already kind of prone to developing resistance just through the process of selection. This outcrossing is more of an issue in the coaxium wheat than it is in the Clearfield wheats, just because of where that herbicide resistance gene is found in the wheat genome. So as we think about those coaxium wheats, we have two kind of modes of developing resistance there if we think about it and we're not careful. So one is just that process of selection, right? Kind of overuse or repeated use of similar herbicides. And then the other would be this idea of outcrossing. And so we can actually send the genes that were intentionally put into the wheat, we can accidentally send those into wild relatives. So this has been documented for other species as well. You know, I think you and I have chatted about the potential for some of our herbicide-resistant traits in grain sorghum to move over to Johnson grass and chattercane. If you go further north, they worry about herbicide-resistant traits in canola outcrossing to some of the wild mustard species. So it's a real issue and something that folks need to be aware of. And it just makes things like keeping your field borders clean, tarping trucks so we're not accidentally spreading seed of a herbicide-resistant crop around the countryside. It just makes those kind of sanitation types of practices that much more important.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
While there have been recent developments in some of these areas, especially trade policy, uncertainty around the changes and their effects on the economic outlook is high.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve is Jerome Powell, following the Federal Open Market Committee hearing on Wednesday.
As we parse the incoming information, we're focused on separating the signal from the noise as the outlook evolves. As we say in our statement, in considering the extent and timing of additional adjustments to the target range for the federal funds rate, the committee will assess incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. We do not need to be in a hurry to adjust our policy stance, and we are well positioned to wait for greater clarity. In our SEP, FOMC participants wrote down their individual assessments of an appropriate path for the federal funds rate based on what each participant judges to be the most likely scenario going forward. An admittedly challenging exercise at this time in light of considerable uncertainty. The median participant projects that the appropriate level of the federal funds rate will be 3.9% at the end of this year and 3.4% at the end of next year, unchanged from December. While these individual forecasts are always subject to uncertainty, as I noted, uncertainty today is unusually elevated. And of course, these projections are not a committee plan or a decision. Policy is not on a preset course. As the economy evolves, we will adjust our policy stance in a manner that best promotes our maximum employment and price stability goals. If the economy remains strong and inflation does not continue to move sustainably toward 2%, we can maintain policy restraint for longer. If the labor market were to weaken unexpectedly or inflation were to fall more quickly than anticipated, we can ease policy accordingly. Our current policy stance is well positioned to deal with the risks and uncertainties that we face in pursuing both sides of our dual mandate. At today's meeting, we also decided to slow the pace of decline in our balance sheet. Since we began balance sheet runoff, our securities holdings have declined by more than $2 trillion. While market indicators continue to suggest that the quantity of reserves remains abundant, we have seen some signs of increased tightness in money markets. Beginning in April, the monthly cap on Treasury redemptions will be lowered from $25 billion to $5 billion. Consistent with the committee's intention to hold primarily Treasury securities in the longer run, we are leaving the cap on agency securities unchanged. This action has no implications for our intended stance of monetary policy and should not affect the size of our balance sheet over the medium term. The committee also continued its discussions as part of our five-year review of our monetary policy framework. At this meeting, we focused on labor market dynamics and our maximum employment goal. As we have indicated, our review will include outreach and public events involving a wide range of parties, including Fed Listens events around the country and a research conference in May. Throughout this process, we will be open to new ideas and critical feedback, and we will take on board lessons of the last 5 years in determining our findings. We intend to wrap up the review by late summer. The Fed has been assigned two goals for monetary policy: maximum employment and stable prices. We remain committed to supporting maximum employment, bringing inflation sustainably to our 2% goal, and keeping longer-term inflation expectations well anchored. Our success in delivering on these goals matters to all Americans. We understand that our actions affect communities, families, and businesses across the country. Everything we do is in service to our public mission. We at the Fed will do everything we can to achieve our maximum employment and price stability goals.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This really is a conversation about what I've referred to really for the last year as the Two Americas story.
Speaking at the recent USDA Ag Outlook Forum, Chad Motre with the National Restaurant Association.
For many Americans, they're doing quite well, right? The stock market's at a record high, housing values at a record high. Wage growth has been pretty solid, and so you're seeing many Americans who are continuing to go out and spend. They're actually keeping the economy afloat in many ways, right? Keeping that overall resilience there. And so that certainly is a large part of it, and as Megan mentioned, many of those folks go to restaurants, right? And so that certainly is helping to keep that resilience in the restaurant sector. And yet for other Americans, you're certainly seeing quite a bit of penny pinching, right? There's that inflationary price pressures have really mounted, and you're seeing that consumer confidence mount pretty significantly. So we're going to be watching consumer confidence pretty closely over the coming months to see what overall happens with it. Note, just a little bit of an asterisk here. Sometimes people wake up on the wrong side of the bed, and yet they'll still go out and buy the latest iPhone, right? And so it doesn't always mean anything, but it's certainly something for us to continue watching. When we in the state of the industry, we were quite aware of this tale of two Americans story, and so we actually asked consumers, "How are you feeling?" And you can see that many consumers are still feeling quite strange in terms of being able to meet the bills that they have, to save up for vacation or retirement, or to go on and do some other things in terms of their lifestyle that they want. And that also plays into the notion of value. So we hear quite a bit in the restaurant side about value. We're all familiar with value meals, right? And restaurants themselves have really tried to present the value that they offer in terms of price but it's not just price, right? You know, when you ask restaurant customers, they're looking for other things that add up to value as well, right? And so depending on the overall experience, you might get a lot of value out of hospitality, going into a restaurant that has a clean space, and there's a lot of other things that are aspects of that that really play into that value consciousness. The other thing that I think restaurant operators have done a really good job of is certainly kind of marrying loyalty with that value consciousness, and that certainly has been a driver for them to continue to get more sales. Consumers themselves are certainly looking for more value, and that certainly is something that restaurants are continuing to try to derive. And you can see here, millennials are the most, in terms of their pushing for more value, although they're all, quite frankly, pretty elevated figures there. And the loyalty program comments that I made a second ago, you can see here the most the millennials and Gen Z, as well as Gen Xers, are certainly going out there and finding value and looking at those loyalty programs. I know I certainly order using those loyalty programs, and so I'm sure you do as well. Okay, so our other forecast for this year is restaurant industry sales are expected to be $1.5 trillion this year. That's a 4.1% increase from what it was in 2024. Also built into that is that we expect menu prices to go up 3.8%. So not too far off of what Megan has suggested. That's actually a little higher than I think some economists are suggesting, but I think given some of the price pressures that are out there, I think it's a pretty realistic one. You can do the math then. Obviously, if your nominal number is going up 4.1% and your prices are going up 3.8, you're eking out a very slight 0.3% gain in terms of real revenue for this year. Still positive, but nonetheless a little bit more flat than we might prefer.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Some of the things that we need to get on before jointing.
Sarah Lancaster is a Kansas State weed specialist on considerations for weed herbicides.
A big one would be dicamba. So dicamba can go on between two leaf and jointing. If you wait too long, it's going to have a significant impact on yield. Other things to think about as far as applications prior to jointing would be the clear field wheats. So a lot of folks are, I think, using double stop, which is a two-gene clear field wheat. And so we can apply up to the second node for clear field wheat. So the other herbicide-tolerant wheats would be the coaxium varieties. And so aggressors should be sprayed after four-leaf, but before jointing begins. And so, timing that so that you're spraying small weeds can be a little bit tricky. The other thing to be aware of for all of our applications to winter wheat this time of year, all of our herbicide applications this time of year, is the influence of temperature on weed growth, right? So we want to get a few days kind of either side of that herbicide application where we have temperatures above freezing and the plants are actively growing so that we can get the herbicides to translocate through the plants. So that's especially important for products like Quazalifop. It's really sensitive to that temperature thing.
Are there some new products to consider?
Some newer products would be things like Tarzac. So Tarzac is a Corteva product that is a combination of PowerFlex and Elevore. So PowerFlex will bring some grass activity and Elevore will bring some broadleaf activity. It's a group 4 herbicide somewhat similar to 2,4-D and dicamba. It will bring good activity on horseweed, not so good activity on some of our other drivers like kochia or Palmer amaranth.
What's available through boot stage?
So applications that can go on through boot stage would be things like Ally 2,4-D would be a big one there. Glean, some of the Starring products. Starring is going to be the one to go for probably if you have kochia that you're trying to control there. And then we should probably talk just a minute more about 2,4-D. Folks that have been growing wheat for a while will know that 2,4-D has to be applied after the plant has started tillering. So the way the herbicide interacts with the hormones in the plant, you can reduce tillering and therefore yield potential if you apply 2,4-D too early. Now, one of the alternatives to that that some folks will opt for would be to use MCPA instead of 2,4-D. It's MCPA is also a group 4 herbicide that is a plant growth regulator, but it doesn't have quite the same negative effects on the wheat as 2,4-D.
And are there other modes of action?
Really, we talk about, let's back up just a minute. 2,4-D and MCPA are both salts formulations, and that means you've got the active ingredient, and then you've got this extra little piece tacked onto it. Okay. And so that extra little piece either makes the formulation an amine, so that's a nitrogen-based piece, or an ester, and that's just more carbon molecules on there. So things to think about are that amine formulations generally don't play as well in tank mixes. ester formulations tend to provide better better weed control. That's kind of a rule of thumb that we talk about in our weed science classes. But as we move into warmer weather and we start thinking about off-target movement, ester formulations tend to be more volatile and more likely to move away from the site of application. So each has their place.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Providing a heads up during Tuesday morning's National Ag Day ceremony at USDA headquarters.
Secretary Rollins will be announcing that USDA is expediting up to $10 billion in direct assistance payments through the Emergency Commodity Assistance Program for the 2024 crop year.
USDA Farm Production and Conservation Deputy Undersecretary Brooke Appleton. The announcement later in the day included details such as sign up starting Wednesday, with pre-filled applications arriving to eligible producers soon after. Producers wishing to apply before their pre-filled applications arrive can do so by going online to www.fsa.usda.gov/ecap, using a login.gov account and password, or by visiting their local Farm Service Agency office. Producers must submit their applications and 2024 acreage report by no later than August 15th. I'm Rod Bain, reporting in Washington, D.C.